Okay, welcome to another Dharma talk here on this retreat. And the subject of this evening's talk is like deep insight. Those of you who have seen the whole series of talks realize this is a graduated series of lectures, of explanations about the path of meditation. And today I'm going to be talking about the way that insight ties in with this practice of deep meditation into jhanas. First of all, I'd just like to make a quote from the sutras, from the Buddhist teachings. It's both found in the Anapanasati Sutta and also the Anapanasati Samyutta, where the Buddha actually says that anyone who practices Anapanasati to the level of jhanas and beyond, such a person, if they complete the 16 steps of Anapanasati, fulfill all the four Satipatthana. By fulfilling the Anapanasati, the Buddha said, you complete the four Satipatthanas. So don't ever think this Anapanasati is different than insight. It is exactly the same. Okay, go up again. I'll try to get closer to the microphone. Okay, so just making a quote from the sutras, and that's where the Buddha equated Satipatthana and Anapanasati. He said that anyone who completes the 16 stages of Anapanasati also completes the four Satipatthanas. So by practicing the Anapanasati to the point of jhana and beyond, you are also doing the four Satipatthanas, gaining insight into the nature of the body, feelings, the mind, and the mind objects. And to understand what we mean here, that sometimes when you're practicing this path of meditation, when the mind gets more and more peaceful, the more peaceful it gets, the deeper it can see. I've already mentioned the fact of superpower mindfulness. But also simplicity is also important to be able to get insight. A long time ago, the Ajahn Chah used this example. An example was of the forest paths in the jungle monasteries of Thailand. It used to be the duty every afternoon for the monks to sweep those paths clean of leaves. And the reason was that once those paths in the jungle had been swept clean of leaves, the sand, which was very white, acted like a ribbon. So you could actually see at night when you were going back to your hut whether there was any snakes or any other creepy crawlies on that path. Because the path was well swept, it became quite safe. But it would become very dangerous walking through the jungle itself. So many leaves and twigs, you wouldn't know what's underneath there at all. And sometimes the bites of the snakes could kill you. According to what I was told, in the first year I became a monk there, they said there were 100 species of snake in Thailand. 99 were venomous. Their bite could kill you. And the other one would strangle you to death. They were all very dangerous. So by sweeping the paths, we could actually keep them clean. We could see things which were there. Only when we swept the paths could we see what was there. Because a snake on a clean, well-swept path would stand out. But a snake in the undergrowth, with the twigs, with the leaves, with the branches, you could not tell it. It was camouflaged. In the same way, there's many of the attachments, defilements, the secrets of the mind are camouflaged when there's so much else going on in the mind. Literally, we can't see it. However, when we sweep the mind clean by doing this calm meditation, when there's nothing much going on there, you can see these little snakes, these little cravings, these little attachments very, very clearly. So that's the first teaching which Ajahn Chah gave on insight. The fact that you're sweeping the path, cleaning out a lot of thoughts, rubbish, concerns, worries, but what you do see, because there's nothing else around, you see it very clearly. You can understand what it is. Because insight is understanding what it is. And on the whole path towards the deep states of mind, you do find that every now and again you come across a barrier. Maybe it's just even like present moment awareness. Sometimes you can't even get into that. Why? Sometimes you get the insights into why we're so worried about the past and the future. What's the purpose? Why are you always thinking? And the insight should come. It's very clear, it's because one has got no happiness in this moment. That is why one is always running somewhere else. And these are insights which are powerful indicators of what the problem is of life. You know why some people are workaholics? It's because they're afraid. They're afraid of being peaceful. Why is it that sometimes you get happiness in your meditation and sometimes people think it's wrong? They're even so afraid of the happiness, they tell you you're going to be attached to it. What's actually happening there is people are afraid of happiness. If you can get that insight into why people are afraid of happiness, why they don't like peace, you're getting some deep understanding into why craving and attachments happened in the first place. There was a nun who was staying in my monastery once, and she was getting into some deep meditation. She got this beautiful nimitta and it became very, very powerful, but she could take it no further. And when she came to talk to me about this, I said, well, why don't you just go into jhana? You're right at the doorway. And she said, because I don't think I deserve so much happiness. And that's what she said. And I understood from that one of the reasons why many people can't get into deep meditation. Sometimes, psychologically, you don't think you deserve it. Any psychologist would say that that's an insight into what many people suffer these days. It's called lack of self-esteem. It's called guilt and punishment. Very often, we've all done things which are wrong, which have been bad in the past. There's not one person who probably hasn't hurt or somebody else or said something they shouldn't say. And what happens too often is we're conditioned into thinking, yeah, we've done something wrong, we need to be punished. And it's that need to punish ourselves, which is called the lack of self-esteem, which gives you guilt and even depression. That's where much of this comes from. A fear of happiness, thinking you don't deserve it. And you can see the retreat like this which I've given, it sometimes goes against the grain. It's very hard to say you can sleep whenever you want. It's very hard to say, well, you meditate, it's happy, enjoy it. So there's something wrong there. Because too many people think that meditation or religion has to be some sort of penance. It's got to be tough. You've got to work hard, it's got to be painful, otherwise it's not religion. And here I'm saying, why is that? Because a lot of times people are afraid of happiness. Now these insights come up at these different stages. And I already mentioned, sometimes why can't you stay silent? What is there to do at this retreat? Everything is laid on. You have nothing to do. And that can be torture for many people, having nothing to do. At times on these retreats, people volunteer for extra duties. Please give me extra chores. Because they hate doing nothing. Sometimes you want to get somewhere, you want to attain something, you want to get something out of this meditation trip. And Ajahn Brahm comes along here and says, it doesn't matter, it's good enough. Don't try and get anywhere. And that's more torture. You feel more comfortable if there's goals. And if I interview you every day and I tick off, yes, you've got this stage of meditation, now go on to the next one. And if at the end of the retreat I give you a report card, just like at school, you'd be very comfortable with that, even if you've got an F. At least you know where you stand. But here, when you don't compare, that really challenges you. This is giving the insight into this ego business of always wanting to compare and control and be something. There's a huge amount of insights happen on this retreat. You're learning what it's like to let go. even that much, learning what letting go means, that's one of the biggest prizes you can get on this retreat. Understanding what it means. Because a lot of times people try letting go all their life, and they still can't do it. But one day, because I've been talking about it from the left, from the right, from this way, from that way, every talk is all about the same thing. Every time you come into the interview, have you ever noticed when you come into your interviews, sometimes people say, I've been so sleepy, I haven't meditated at all today. And I say, very good. And sometimes they say, I've just got this amazing limit. I say, very good. Sometimes they say, I just spent the last 3 hours just thinking. Very good. I say, you know, you spent the last couple of hours sort of talking with your friend. I say, very good. I say, what's he up to? He always says, very good, no matter what. Now you can understand that why are you always wanting comparisons? I just say very good to everything. Because I know it's all very good. So when you're getting some deep insights into what's going on and what letting go truly is. And as you meditate, when you understand what letting go is, when you understand what freedom is, when you don't compare, when you're content and you're allow yourself to be happy, you're not afraid of peace, then peace comes. You're sitting here and nothing's happening. And you're content to have nothing happening. You get the insight. Why do people think so much? Because they want to, they're afraid of that peace. Why come they watch the breath? Because they're afraid of losing control. Because you have to give up control to watch the breath. You're getting insight into what this doer, what this controller is. We're always manipulating, managing, controlling, doing everything. We're doing our life, and now you're doing a retreat. You're not doing anything. If you learn how to let go, you just sit here, shut up, and be mindful. That's a little joke in my monastery. Because I have to teach my monks how to be teachers. And I tell them, if ever you do a meditation retreat, at all your interviews, no matter what the yogi asks, no matter what their problem is, no matter what they report, just tell them the same thing. Very good to sit down, shut up, and be mindful. That's basic instructions for meditation. But don't do anything. So that as you do this, you find that if you have those insights, if you truly understand what the problems are, then you find silence is easy. Present moment awareness is easy. When you watch the breath, why can't you watch the breath? Because we interfere with it. You're getting insight into the interfering mind, which is another type of craving, another type of doing. And if you can do that with the breath, you can just watch the breath, and it's just so natural, you're so content, you don't want to do anything, you don't want it to go anywhere, it's quite okay as it is. Then you get the insights into being with something without interfering. And you can apply that insight to your daily life. You at last can be at peace with your partner. You can just have a husband without interfering with him and wanting him to be something different. You can have your wife and love her for who she is instead of trying to change her. It's non-interfering. It's a type of letting go. It's just appreciating this moment for what it is. You appreciate the breath for what it is. It's an insight into accepting, leaving it alone, being with rather than being against. We're against too many things in life. We're with too little. You learn how to be with something. That is a deep insight. But the bigger insights, the best insights, come when the breath starts to disappear. Just before it disappears, it becomes beautiful. And some of you have already, many of you have already gone through that stage of what I call the beautiful breath. You're sitting here and it's just so nice. Just watching the breath go in, watching the breath go out. You're just so content and so happy. You don't want to go anywhere. And some of you have already missed your lunch. Imagine all the visitors here. Some of these yogis, they don't eat after 12 o'clock, they won't eat till tomorrow morning. And they have their, supposed to have their lunch around 11 o'clock, they don't want it, because they're just too happy meditating. Imagine what happiness that must be, if you can give up your lunch knowing you've got no dinner coming afterwards. Now, this gives the data for huge insights. Why is that so happy, happier than eating this beautiful breath? Why is it happy? You're finding here just that peace, tranquility, simplicity is a source of enormous happiness. The reason it's happy is because doing things, changing things, making decisions is a big burden. It's called suffering. It's called craving. It's called dukkha. When you hear those Four Noble Truths as a Buddhist, sometimes you say, yeah, dukkha, but what actually is it? Now you see what dukkha is when it's disappeared. You get some happiness, some peace, the happiness of peace. And when that beautiful breath disappears and you get these nimittas, and these get huge insights coming. Number one, just why are those nimittas, when they come up, incredibly powerful? If you stay with those nimittas and they establish themselves, that by itself is huge amounts of bliss. Just so happy. That's why some meditators, when the nimitta comes up in full force, they get afraid. Again, they're afraid of being happy. But also, if you reflect afterwards, why is that happy? What's the source of that happiness? And I mentioned this either this morning or last night. When you use that data, those experiences of deep meditation, you reflect about them afterwards and find out what they mean, you find out one of the big insights at this stage. The reason why that nimitta is associated with so much happiness, with so much bliss, is because a huge amount of dukkha has been taken away. The body, and with it all these senses. To see things is a pain. To hear is a distraction. And to feel is a disturbance. When all of those things disappear, and you're left with the mind, you feel incredibly free, and so light, and so joyful, not having to be burdened with all this seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching business. I mentioned this last night. No matter what music you like, no matter what sights you like, when all of those things disappear, it is far more pleasurable, more beautiful. Why is it in our world we seek beautiful sights and sounds and touches and tastes, when we realize that even the best of those is nowhere near as good as when everything disappears? Now you understand why the Buddha would say that to see is suffering, to hear, to smell, to taste, to have physical touch is suffering, to have a human body is suffering. You know there's a truth because you put all those things aside. And you realize that once that suffering is put aside, the body has disappeared, the five senses are gone, then you feel so free, so happy. A big burden has disappeared. Just like you were sick with some terrible fever, and now the fever is gone, you're cured. The ache is gone, the pain has disappeared. Oh, you feel so good. That's what it's like. Because you have the experience, you have the data. Now you reflect upon it. This is what insight means. The reason why many people don't get the insights which give rise to full understanding of what Buddhism is all about, the reason why they don't get the insights which cause enlightenment, is because they don't get enough data. Not enough experience of what happens when things disappear. When they go into the deep states of mind, when they get bliss and freedom. Because they haven't got the data, the raw experience, they've got nothing to work with. And so all the insights they get, which is ordinary states of mind, don't see deeply into what's happening. For example, at that stage when the nimitta appears, or just beyond when you get to the jhanas, you're coming face to face with the mind. And even today, you see, people, they discuss and argue whether the mind exists or what is the mind. Many scientists try and maintain that the mind is part of the brain. It's a crazy idea. The mind is completely separate from the brain. Yeah, they say, prove it. And I say, okay, sit down and get into jhana and you'll know for yourself. I'll prove it for you. Get someone to get into a jhana and put the EEG on their brain. The brain is dead. But they're perfectly alert and awake. Explain that, Mr. Scientist. I was a scientist before, so I know what the scientific method is. But what about that for you? How do you know what the mind is? I'm going to give a little experiment now. It's one of my experiments, my object lessons, which I sometimes do. I haven't done this one for a while yet. I'm going to ask you to participate. What is this? What is it I'm holding up on my hand? Yes, what else is it? Yeah, what else? What else can you tell me about what I'm holding in my hand here? What else is it? Yeah, you might say it's wide, it's got a picture of an apple on it, maybe sort of 4 inches high, it's cylindrical with something on it. Keep on looking, what else can you see? Now this is an exercise. What happens when I ask you what this is? Everyone first said, cup. And they thought that's all it was. So they thought they got the right answer, and they could leave it alone and go on to something else. When I said, what else is it? You start to see more. You start to see it's white. It's an apple, got a picture of an apple on it, 4 inches high. Look again, what else can you see? The longer you look, the more you see. After a while, all of the names, all of the descriptions, when all of those are exhausted, then you can maybe see what it truly is. This is the problem with many people not understanding what things are. They give it a name and they think that's what it is, and they go on to something else. Superficial labelling. Who is this? Ajahn Brahm. No, it's not. That's just my name. Does that describe everything this is? Of course not. But sometimes they say, oh, I know him, he's Ajahn Brahm. Who do you live with in your house? You may know the name of your husband, your wife, but is that who she really is? Sometimes you just, as if you hold her up. Who is this? You give the name, the history, her character, all you know about her. But I guarantee she's much more than that. Now you understand how insight happens. You have to take something up and allow the mind to play with it long enough for all the labels to disappear, to try and find out what it truly is. Many years ago, in Harvard, the university, there was a famous scientist. In those days, people were biologists, geologists, physicists, they did everything. And this guy had a great reputation at that university. And one day he advertised for some research assistants. And the fellow who would later write this great scientist biography was one of those research assistants. He volunteered to work with this great man. And so he was invited for an interview in the lab. He thought he'd be given some sort of written test or, you know, some sort of verbal examination of science. But all the great professor did was to get a fish, a pickled fish, out of a jar, put it on the bench in the laboratory, and tell the student just to please keep looking at that fish. Tell me what you see. And when you finish noticing things, let me know. Just like I said, what's this? The professor put down a fish. After 2 or 3 hours, the professor said, have you finished with the fish yet? And this student said, actually, no, the longer I look, the more I see. And the professor said, go and get some lunch and come back in the afternoon. And he came back in the afternoon, continued to look at that fish until late in the evening. The professor said, go home now, come back tomorrow. For 3 days, this student looked at the fish and would always see something new. And after 3 days, the professor said, great, I can use you. You're hired. That's a great scientist. If you just saw what you were taught, anybody knows that. That's just what you're taught in school. You know, in little pictures in primary school, mug, girl, boy, Buddha, Kuan Yin. You're taught that. Those are the names. But is that the real thing? For insight, you've got to go much deeper. And I mention this because what's mind? Don't go with all that you've been told what it is, all the names and the labels. To get insight, you have to look at this thing, allow the mind to play on it, to find out what it truly is, to delve deeper. So to have insight, we need to hold something still in our mind, long enough to find out what it truly is. That's the job of samadhi, to be able to sustain your attention long enough to see what's truly there. For the penny to drop, for the insight to happen. Ah, that's what it is. And I mention this mind because the nature of the mind is fundamental to your understanding of life, of who you are and what your place in the world is. The nature of the mind. I've given this simile some years ago. It's a good simile. Imagine there's a very powerful emperor. And this emperor is so powerful that it basically rules your life. The trouble is, you're not quite sure who or what this emperor is. Because whenever you see the emperor, he's clothed in 5 garments which cover every part of his skin. He has boots which go up past his knee to his thighs. He's got trousers which go high up his waist and cover the top of his boots. He's got a jacket which covers the lower part of his trousers, which goes up to his necks, with sleeves which go right down to his wrists. On his hands he's got big leather gloves which cover the lower part of the shirt, which goes halfway up his arms. And on his head he's got this huge helmet which covers all of his head and goes over his shoulders. Every part of his body is covered. So you don't even know whether this emperor is a girl or a boy, whether he's Australian, Malaysian, African or whatever. Because you can't see this emperor because he's covered in the 5 garments. You know, the only way to find out who this emperor is actually to take off those garments, to see the emperor in the raw. In this simile, the emperor stands for your mind. The 5 garments stand for the 5 senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. And the only way, and this is a very accurate simile, to know what your mind is to put down seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing and touching, the 5 senses, to put them down until they completely disappear. And what you're left with is the mind unclothed. And this is what you do in this meditation. But once you see that mind, you'll understand what that mind is. The first thing you'll understand is this mind is not a girl or a boy. Gender stops at the body, which is why we have something in common. Even if you come from Australia or Malaysia, no matter what gender you are, that's why we can relate to each other. In fact, the mind doesn't change from species to species. Even that dog who came in here a few moments ago has the same type of mind as you and I. The mind is independent of the body. Once you understand that, You understand why it can be that you can take rebirth as a boy, as a girl, as a dog, as many different species. The mind is independent of the body. These are insights which come up from the data of having that mind unclothed from the five senses. Pure, not covered, you can see it what it truly is. In particular, as I've been indicating on this little analogy, when you see what that mind is, and you understand it is independent of this body, that's so clear when you take off the five senses, then you understand why the rebirth happens, why there is such a thing as reincarnation. It's just so obvious to you. And that's important for people to understand these days. The insight into the truth of rebirth solves so much pain and gives you what we call the big picture. Because if we know there is such a thing as rebirth, if the whole human race could accept that much, then it's huge consequences. It means we will not be so upset, say, when a young child dies. We would not be so upset, you women, if you have an abortion. Because that being will probably try and come back again. It didn't make it the first time, it will come back a second time. It's not so much killing, it's more like delaying their entry into your life. Can you see the different aspect there? When somebody dies young, it's just they've got another chance. They can come back again and have a longer life the next time. If there's a tsunami, sure, lots of people die. But if you know they're coming back again, is it such? It's still a tragedy, but is it such a tragedy? It means that when we have older people, if we know they're going to come back again, we'd look after them better. Because the elderly people, looking after them is an investment for our future. Why is it that all countries give huge resources to schools and children? Because we keep on saying that's our future. Even like if you want to have a youth conference or a youth group for Buddhism, we say we are developing the leaders for our future. And I say you should start an oldies group and look after them, because then you are developing the leaders in the next life. And what happens these days, it may not be so much the case in Malaysia, because there's still the Chinese culture is much stronger, more compassionate than the Western culture. But in the Western culture, too many people put their parents or their grandparents in the old people's homes and forget about them. And I've seen some of the cases there of people being abandoned in these institutions. And because of monetary constraints, it's not very pleasant. If you don't look after your old people, then what's going to happen when they get reborn as youth? I tell people in Australia, all the trouble with the youth in Australia is all because you did not look after them when they're old people. They're now exerting their revenge. So, if you understand what rebirth is, reincarnation is, that elderly people are just as valuable as young people. They're just in another cycle of life and they're going to come back. And you understand why it's so important to look after even elderly people. This is one example of the consequences of the insights into rebirth and reincarnation. Also means any of you who are getting close to dying, you've got a cancer, or you've got some heart disease, or some other degenerative disease, and you're close to death, you don't worry so much about dying. Big deal, I'm going to die, you've done it before, here we go again. What's the big worry? Why do people worry so much about dying? To the point there's huge resources applied to try and keep people from dying, to try and keep them alive at all costs. And of course this is a huge ethical and social problem now. As medicine advances, as we get more resources and we're smarter keeping people alive, there's coming the decision which already is coming in UK, because I read an article about this, is going to come in Malaysia. There's just not enough money to keep everybody alive. Whether it's kids who were born prematurely, the amount of money it takes to keep those kids alive and actually bring them into life, or the amount of money and resources it takes to keep old people sort of keep on going when much of their body has deteriorated. Those resources, couldn't they be better used in sort of giving people, say, angioplasts, looking after people's diets, the ordinary operations which some people just can't afford? There is going to be a debate, it's coming. And if we have insights such as insight into rebirth, that it's a truth, it makes these debates, these ethical debates, on how we can apportion the limited resources of health, it makes it very clear how we should do this. So these are insights with huge social consequences. However, if you get into those deep states of mind, which I'm trying to encourage you to, and you see what this mind is, you see when the body's disappeared, you keep seeing and seeing and seeing it until it gets so obvious to you, this mind does not die when the body dies. You understand what rebirth is. And at last you'll know for yourself that you will get reborn. You weren't coming from nowhere, you came from your previous life. And I like to keep on going at that with this insight by getting people to remember their past lives. And this is actually one of the insights which the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree. If you read in the suttas, the first watch of the night, he recalled his past lives. The second, he understood the law of karma. The third, he penetrated the Four Noble Truths. And that was his enlightened experience. He called it the Te Wija, the three knowledges, or you might call it the three insights, the three big ones. And I love to encourage people to get that first Wija, to remember your past lives, to get insight that yes, you were born before. Because that, again, will have huge consequences into the way you live your life. People who remember their past lives, number one, are not afraid of death. They have the big picture, they know what happened before, and they know why they got reborn, and what's important in life. If you know what death is, what life is, then you become far less concerned about material things in this world. Because you've had material things before and they've all gone in your death. You understand what is truly worthwhile in life. What is has truly true value. And you don't need to be taught this by a monk. You see this for yourself. So, I've been teaching for quite a few years now that when you get into these deep states of meditation, even getting to the stage of nimitta can sometimes be enough. Certainly after you've got a jhana experience. But when the mind is that powerful and that still, the body's disappeared, you've got a beautiful nimitta coming up, or you've just got this incredible jhana experience. When you come out of these stages, the mind is so supple that you just say these one words or one sentence, "What is my earliest memory?" Just say that. It's a suggestion to the mind. And because the mind is just so subtle, so poised, so plastic, it will just go and search for an early memory and bring it up to you. I know I've given this talk before in several places, and I think I already mentioned when somebody asked me earlier about psychic powers or stuff like that, that I, as a monk who keeps my rules, is very constrained in what I can tell you about. Telling other people about your past lives in public is against the rules. I'm not making this up, it's the 8th Pajitya. So what I usually do, I get around this by using a loophole. And the loophole is, I can tell you of my early life and just how it works, but I can't tell you what happens when you get your past lives. So I usually tell people, the first time I started playing around with this, I don't know where I got the idea from, but it works. Having a nice deep meditation, I ask myself, what is my earliest memory? And within a couple of seconds, I had this strange smell in my nostrils. I was smelling it. It's not imagination. It was real, a smell in my nostrils. And with that smell came the recognition what that smell was. I recognized it immediately. It was the smell of my baby's pram. And with that recognition, I was back in my pram as a baby. I don't know, maybe forget exactly when the first time this happened, maybe 30 years gap. Sort of an adult, and now 2 or 3 week old baby. You were back there. And once you were back there, everything about that pram, not just the smell, but all the toys, the colour of the pram, the size of it, you were back in there. As if you were re-experiencing something a long time ago. And it's fascinating to have these experiences. And I recall, and I can, because that experience is imprinted in me now, I can recall it even now. Recall that on a string which was stretched across the front of my pram were a number of toys, and the favourite one of those toys was a plastic, well, not really plastic, it was like ceramic, blue pig, which was called Porky. My mother called it Porky, the pig. And it would just have some beads or something inside which would make it rattle. And my mother would delight me for hours on end by just moving it, making it walk and rattle, Porky the pig. And that was my favourite toy when I was a few weeks old. And there I was, as an old mug, remembering all this. With clarity. And it shocked me at first that you could have such a clear memory of an early part of your life. Not like your ordinary memories, which is so vague. Maybe you remember this, but you're not really sure. It was actually being right back there again. With all of the surroundings very clear to you. What was eventually fascinating was when I asked the doctor, I told the doctor about that, and he came up and said, you know, that's really fascinating, because children in that time of their life, the sense which they notice their surroundings by is their sense of smell. Because your sense of sight and hearing is not yet well developed in the early ages of infancy. You recognize your pram and your mother by her smell, nothing else. And I know that's true, because I can remember it. That's how you used to recognize my mum. Couldn't see her so well, but I could smell her. That's why I knew my pram. It was my home, by its smell. Now these incredible sort of insights there, you think, wow, you can actually do this. And it's real. Sometimes people have a lot of fun with this. In one of the retreats, there was one lady, she was a Malaysian living in Australia. When I told her to do this, again, she had a very pure-minded person, so she got into deep meditation very easily. And I asked her to do this, what's my earliest memory? And she got herself again in the first weeks of her life. It seems to be a common time when you first go back. And she saw herself in her mother's arms, and she looked up, and she was shocked. Because the woman who was nursing her, who was cradling her, was not her mother. At least, not the person she thought was her mother. And so she came to terms with that in an interview. She said, I had this experience. It's just like you said, you got back this early memory. You just right back there again. You could see everything, hear everything, feel it, smell it. And I was in my mother's arms. I looked up. That's not my mum. So I told her, well, you've got to, better when you get off this retreat, you know, you've got something to ask your mother. And so she did. She couldn't wait to get off the retreat. And she went out to her mum and said, Mother, is there something you haven't told me? Have I been adopted? Are you my real mum? And her mother was taken aback. What do you mean? And she told the story of what happened in the meditation. She was back there as a 2-week-old kid, and she looked up into the face of someone she couldn't recognize. And her mother was intrigued. And asked her, describe that lady. And of course, because these are very vivid experiences, you can describe them perfectly, as if they're standing right in front of you now. How high will they look like? And the mother was so amazed. She said, that was your nanny, your wet nurse. when I first gave birth to you, we hired a wet nurse for you to look after you. And her mother was really impressed that her 30, 40-year-old daughter could remember a girl who was hired just for a few weeks at the time when she was newly born. That's what your mind can do when it's that still and peaceful and empowered. So the next thing you do is you say, earlier memory, please. That's what you say. Earlier, please. And this mind, when it's that state of stillness, it's just so obedient. It just runs off and brings you something back. And that's where you get your past lives from. And the amazing thing about those insights, those experiences, and it's a strange thing, right? Only people who've had the experience understand what I'm talking about. You're absolutely sure that was you. There's no doubt at all. That certainty which comes from those experiences is really weird. When I got that profound experience, you never think that's imagination. If the thought it could be imagination just doesn't even come into the picture. You know it's real, that was you. You've got this very clear, perfect memory. That's what happens with your past lives as well. You know, yeah, that was you. Another time, another place. And because of its certainty, never again will you have any doubt whatsoever that you've lived before. From this meditation, that insight is so powerful. That does change much of the way you look at life. For a start, you know which religions are telling the truth and which aren't. You've got your own understanding. More than that, you've got more direction in life. When you start to look at what you did before in a previous life, some things which you worry about in this life, they're not important anymore. If you remember what happened in the past life, when you know what you're doing in this life, then you know exactly what's important. What's important is the old Buddhist principles, being generous, doing charity, being kind, being compassionate. For goodness sake, be forgiving. Doesn't matter who did what, you ask forgiveness first. And keeping precepts, meditating, developing your mind, that's what's important. Because that's what goes from life to life. The body, it just gets old and dies. You've done it before, you've seen that. So those insights are powerful. They do change your life. And they're not that hard to achieve. Many of you are getting close to deep meditation or you've experienced deep meditation. So I ask you just to make that suggestion. What is my earliest memory? And wait. If it's going to happen, it will happen straight away. You don't have to force it. There's no sort of maybes or maybe not. If it comes with absolute clarity straight away. If it doesn't, you're not quiet enough yet. Do some more meditation, be more peaceful. It's a classic Buddhist insight into previous lives. And as you go into these meditations, especially into the deep jhanas, then afterwards you come out, and after a while you've got this data. I call it the data, because I was a scientist before, I know that language. You've got the data of the jhanic experiences. You've been in this incredible, powerful state of mind. And afterwards, you can't help but try and find out what was that? And also, why was that? These jhanas, I described them yesterday to you. And one of the most important part of those jhanas is that will and choice has completely disappeared. And that is a strange experience. It's the only time in your conscious life that you can be without being able to do anything. That you are mindful but not able to move. You're conscious but not without any will, without any choice. And that's a strange experience to see you are but nothing can be done. You're absolutely still, motionless. When you look at that afterwards, first of all, the reason why that's even more happy than the nimitta state, that's huge ecstasy. It's straight away you realize all this doing business, all this craving and wanting and choosing and managing and being discontent and wanting something more, all this traveling through time is suffering. Because when you stop, it's just so wonderful. You realize that you've been on a journey without pausing. And this is a deep journey. You haven't stopped since the time you were born. You've always been doing something. And I mean that in the deepest way. Sometimes you think you've been resting, but you've still been doing something. Thinking, planning, remembering, watching the TV, reading the books. You've always been doing something. This is the first time you stop. I mentioned this to someone today. There's the old adage, the old proverb. When you journey through life, please stop to smell the roses. What that means is please enter jhanas to stop. So you can really enjoy nothing, stillness, peace. It's only when you stop once do you realize what stopping is. You understand just how you've always been on the move in your mind. You've always been going somewhere, trying to get something, always traveling. No wonder you're tired. Now, you literally stop for the first time in your life. You stop willing, you stop doing, the mind has come to rest. Oh, what bliss. There's an old Pali phrase which these monks in the time of the Buddha sometimes would be sitting there saying, Aho Sukhang, Aho Sukhang, Aho Sukhang, one of my favourite words. It means, oh what bliss, oh what bliss, oh what bliss, Aho Sukhang. That's what you say after jhana. Oh what bliss, oh what bliss. What happens when people stop? At last they stopped and rested. You get the insight into what craving is, and what attachment is, what all this work is. You've worked so much, you haven't stopped yet. Not once since you were born. If you get into a jhana, you stop for the first time. Oh, what bliss. You get the insight into one of the great sufferings of life. Never being able to stop, always being on the move, always being on the go, mentally. Now, but being fully conscious at the same time. One of the great insights into this is to know that this doer, this will, is suffering, is dukkha. I'm going to say a bit more about that tomorrow, about the will being emptiness. No one there. Tomorrow, and I don't want to sort of get into that because that's one of my favourite teachings. The fact that you had no choice, each one of you, on this retreat. You had to come to this retreat. There's no ifs and buts about it. You're fully conditioned to come here. And even you, sitting in the back here listening, you had no choice. You thought that you decided to come here this evening. But I'm going to explain to you tomorrow. There was an inevitability, you had to come. There's no one in there calling the shots. But I'll talk about that tomorrow in emptiness. I love that little talk I'm going to give tomorrow. I gave a talk like this on emptiness of the will in Singapore the first time, and a lot of people complained afterwards. They went back, they were so scared they didn't sleep that night. They were terrified. But that comes tomorrow. So in this incredible data you get great insights into what the mind is. First of all, you see the nature of the mind is completely free from the body and the five senses. And then you see the mind can let go of the doer, the will. And all you've got left is consciousness. Pure knowing which can't move. What happens next is that knowing starts to disintegrate. Even consciousness fades away. and you get the great insight into you're not even the one who knows. Even that's not you. When you get that insight, that's one of the enlightening insights. Seeing non-self. You've seen the mind right in front of you in these nimitta states or the jhanas, and it's just so strong. You see it and see it, and you realize, my goodness, there's nothing here. That's the seeing in, the insight. Things have vanished. Please understand that the insight, especially into impermanence, sometimes that people think that they can know impermanence, the rise and fall of phenomena, without getting into these deep states of meditation. And I've given a simile, two similes about this, to show what real insight into impermanence is. One day a person is sitting by the lake, and they see the lake rise and fall, the waves on the lake. And they think that that's impermanence, rise and fall, rise and fall. However, one day they're sitting by the lake, and because of their deep meditation, rise and fall, they see the lake go up and down, and then without any warning, the lake completely vanishes, as well as the hills and the land surrounding that lake. Everything is gone. That's what impermanence is. It's not just a lake going up and going down. It's a lake completely disappearing. And it's not supposed to do that. It's things which were always there, which you have always known. Now they completely disappear for the first time in your life. Like the knower, rather than say the doer, this will. Will has always been there. Sure, the will comes and goes, but it's always been there. In the jhanas, it's completely vanished. And it's not supposed to vanish. But it has. To see, it's empty. Number two, simile. It's like you're watching a TV. And the TV has got five channels. Sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch sound. And sure enough, you can see the impermanence. The channels change, and the content of the channels comes and goes. Sights come, sounds come, rise and fall. Here the traffic comes, the traffic goes. Lights come on, lights go off. You can hear the impermanence. But one day, you can even turn the TV off. But you can still see the blank screen without any channels on it. That's like the mind channel. But then one day, you're watching this TV, and the TV disappears. It vanishes out of existence. And that is not covered by the warranty. What this means in this simile is just watching this body and the mind. Watching it. Sure, it changes, but one day it completely disappears. And that is very challenging. That is the data where true insights come from. Where something which has always been there, which you thought was so solid, which you rested all your ideas of life and me on, is taken away from you. And now you have a completely different understanding of who you truly are. Which is why these deep meditations give you insights which challenge you so deeply that when the real big insights come, they completely change the way you look at life, completely change your attitude to yourself, completely undermine all of the old illusions. As one of my disciples in Perth said, these defilements of greed, hatred and delusion are so tough, you need a big whack to be able to dislodge them. And those big whacks are jhanas. So powerful that these delusions, wrong ways of looking, which have been there for lifetimes, are finally overcome. you see things anew, you become one of the enlightened ones. That's how it happens. And this story will be continued tomorrow with the emptiness of the self, and afterwards what happens when you become enlightened. But that's enough for now on the deep insights. Any questions? That was pretty quick. Yeah, go on.
How can one know that the insights one gains based on again listening of profound dharma or deep meditation are real insights into the true nature of things, or due to program conditioned thinking and experiences from one's past or past life?
You can always tell the great sign of the deep insights is they scare the pants off you. They're terrifying. You see things which you don't expect to see. This can't be happening, but it's true. They're completely overturned. I've given the simile, it's like an explosion going off. This huge explosion and all of those old views, the way you looked at life, is completely demolished. You see things in a different way. It's a catharsis, a change from being one of the larvae to one of the butterflies. If the insight is comfortable, then it's not a real insight. If you think, oh, this, yeah, I understand this now, that's not strong enough. You think, my God, this is, whoa, Then that's one of the big insights. It knocks you about. And just sometimes it's like the jhana experiences. After the jhana experiences, people are just so sensitive. After the deep, powerful insights, people have just got their head in the clouds sometimes for days, completely blissed out. You know, in the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, the old story says, and it's from the very original old teachings, that after his enlightenment, the Buddha spent 7 days standing, just staring without blinking at the Bodhi tree. So that's physiologically impossible, ask any doctor. Once you understand what a great insight is, that makes so much sense to me. I really think that happened. After great insight, you were so rocked, you're stunned. And an insight like the Buddha had, that would have stunned him. He would have been like that, just staring in bliss, just completely old ideas completely wiped out. So that's the great insights. It really rocks you. Not the comfortable ones. Yeah, impermanence, yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I thought about that already. The ones which are completely new way of thinking. That's why you cannot think your way to enlightenment. All the thinking, as you were suggesting, that goes in the old channels. You think according to your conditioned mind. Just as I was saying, all the things you've been told what this cup is, now all of those things you've got to put aside, and you've got to see it as if for the first time, in a completely new way. That's the deepest. So they happen naturally. When they do happen, it's lovely to see. The people are spinning, but they're just so wonderful afterwards. Any other questions about the deep insights? It's, yeah, go on. Go on, yeah. You didn't have any food to eat? Yeah, probably not. Didn't need any food for those 7 weeks. Look, already, I mean, some of the amazing things about deep meditation. I already mentioned yesterday you don't need to breathe in deep meditation. That's been well seen, well proved. But more than that, if you've just got so much energy there, energy from the mind, the body doesn't consume much. It's so still. You're not consuming any energy. It's just like your car is just in the garage. It's like the bear hibernating. It doesn't consume anything. That's why you don't need to eat. So in such stages of deep stillness and peace. Wow, that's great. I make this point because I wanted to show that there's no such thing as two types of meditation, Vipassana Samatha. The two always go together. They have to go together. The job of the jhanas is to empower the mind to get it still and really peaceful so it can see deeply. And the insight has to be so empowered, so still, to be able to see just what is very, very difficult to see. Some of the insights are scary. As you know, I mentioned about the insights into non-self are the most scary of all. But the mind becomes so powerful and so blissful, the energy makes it courageous. Have you ever noticed like drunk people are always courageous? I don't know if you have this problem in Malaysia, but in Australia that many criminals were taking this ecstasy, these uppers, and when they were taking these ecstasy, they go into houses, wouldn't be afraid. And even if other people were there. Usually, if you're burgling a house, you'd be very afraid that someone else will attack you. Or be very afraid of the police. Or, some of these kids would steal a car and drive at 150 kilometres an hour, 200 kilometres an hour. And the reason if you did that, you'd be scared stiff. But these kids, because they're taking this ecstasy, they've got so much energy, so much power, they don't feel fear. It's similar, it's not a good simile, but it's the best I can come from. It's why when your mind is that empowered by meditation, you don't feel fear against these insights. Whatever is truth, you're going to go for it no matter what it is. It doesn't mean after meditation you go driving your car at 200 kilometers an hour, that's too impossible, just too still. But the only simile here is the courage which you have. Too often, the reason why people don't find out the truth is because they don't want to know the truth. They're too afraid to find out what really is true. To be willing to throw away everything you've ever heard and learned before. Even to be willing to throw away all of Buddhist teachings, the whole lot. If it's not true, chuck it away. Your truth, search for truth, is more important than any old ideas or beliefs. The point being, though, that if you find those pieces, you're courageous enough, you'll find how brilliant the Buddha was in his description of what happens. So, you've got to be courageous. And the energies of the mind supplies that courage, that fearlessness to see who is in here. Who is deciding what to do? Who am I? What is life? What is happiness? Yes. Okay. You're asking what happens if somebody gets into a jhana, they don't have any Dharma knowledge. What actually happens is they have these incredible experiences and they just don't know what it was and they're just waiting for someone to explain it to them. Sometimes they know they're not crazy because they feel more sane, more at peace. It doesn't have the hallmarks of craziness, of like harming yourself and doing stupid things. You're just incredibly peaceful after the jhana, huge amounts of energy, and very sharp. It's the opposite of being crazy. It's being more sane than you usually are. However, many people have the, I suppose, the innate wisdom to look back and find out what it was. And if they can penetrate, there may be things like Pajeka Buddhas, self-enlightened beings. But if they haven't got any teachings or guidance, they'll just push it aside as saying a wonderful experience which they don't understand. and they just wait for some sort of teacher to come along. This has happened to me, but I've taught like this many times, and people come up afterwards and say, oh, thank goodness, Ajahn Brahm, and now I understand what happened. They've had these experiences. These are Westerners. For some reason or another, they've pressed that letting go button, they've gone into these jhanas, and all these things have happened exactly as I've said. At last, someone has explained it to me, that what actually happened. This is what happened. And then I can actually ask them to, well, try it again, and this time do that, that time do this. And to actually to guide them through. But when I talk about enlightenment, these insights are the stuff of enlightenment. To be able to gain the insights which can create enlightenment, I've mentioned this again in a couple of nights' time, to become like the first stage of enlightenment, the stream winner. The Buddha said there's two causes to becoming a stream winner. The first is called Yoni Samanasikara, which literally means work of the mind which goes to the source. And the second is Paratagosa, which means the words or teachings of another. The teachings of another mean like the Dhamma, heard from a Buddha or from another Aryan, someone who's teaching from experience. That's important, that's one of the main causes. Yoni Samanasikara, work of the mind which goes back to the source, which too often people just translate meaninglessly as wise attention. What is wise attention? Everyone says they're wise attention. But what it truly means, work of the mind which goes to the yoni, the womb, the center of things. That's what the jhana is. It's going to the center of the thousand-petal lotus. It's work of the mind, which is just mindfulness, which opens things out and goes to the center of things. When you get into the jhana, you go into the center of you, into this mind. You unclothe the emperor, see what this thing which is controlling you, the center of you, your mind, see what it truly is. When you actually go into the center, see what this mind truly is through your own experience, and you have the teachings of the Buddha to help you. Those two together cause the table to stream in. You've got the guidebook, now you're in Paris, then you'll find the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre, everything. Just as it says. You know what those things mean. So this is what deep inside is. You've got another question? Go on. Yeah.
And some of them, you say, some are very horrible, horrifying. For example, you can see the position of all the things that so much, and then everything is past, so you can see your body destroying. So, in solving and so on, you're very horrible. Even during the Buddha's life, I've heard that some monks are feeling very difficult for their pressure, and they want to commit themselves, from which type of self. So, the Buddha advised that to work. So, the question is, we as ordinary yogis come to that state without any proper master or guidance, which is dangerous to go into deep insight.
Okay. The deep insight is not dangerous at all. The story you were talking about was the monks they called on the banks of the river Wagamudu. And the Buddha was teaching them the asupa practices about the loathsomeness or the unattractiveness of the body. And that's one of the practices which monks teach other monks, especially this is preliminary practice to stop them getting into lust. Now I don't know, many of you may have actually seen this at novice ordinations, that part of the traditional novice ordination is to give them the five recollections of hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. If any of you have been in a novice program, you may remember that. Kesa, Loma, Naka, Danta, Tacho, Tacha, Tacho, Danta, Naka, Loma, Kesa. You have to recite that back and forth. You remember that? Why did the Buddha give that reflection or that meditation to his young novices? It was because that when you're just ordained as a novice, you're usually quite young and you've still got your lust. You might see a pretty girl and fall in love, and that's the end of your monkhood. So he gave these five reflections, the same reflections for a nun, becoming a nun, because when you look at a pretty boy, a hunky boy, or if you look at sort of a pretty girl, what do you see? All that's on the outside of your body is like hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. That's what's on the outside. And when you contemplate this, you know that the hair which you see is all dead stuff. Because the roots actually are underneath the skin. You can't see them. But actually the hair which you see is all dead matter, whether it's off the body or off the head. And your nails, it's the same. Your nails which you see is dead. The roots are underneath. The teeth, the same. That's dead. The root is underneath there somewhere in the gum. And what about the skin? Exactly the same. This is all dead on the outside. That's why it actually flakes off. If you scratch it in the sunlight, you can see it all flaking off. So the outside of the skin is all dead. The live stuff is a millimeter or two underneath. So we tell that to our young novices. If you see this beautiful model coming into the monastery, all you see is dead stuff. And if you feel like you want to kiss her, be careful. Well, as soon as you plant your lips on her skin, you're kissing dead stuff. Yuck. Want to stroke her nice hair, it's all dead stuff. And it's true, isn't it? So when you say that, you're just protecting the novices for a few weeks until they get their act together. And then they can actually start practicing meditation. So the super meditations, it's only just a balance. You know, there's sometimes the lust which we have. And I'm just getting off on this now. When I was a young monk, to protect myself, I noticed as a boy, whenever you see a pretty girl, you'd always go to that part of her which was the most prettiest. If she had nice hair, that's where you'd look at. If she had a nice figure, you'd go to her figure. Whatever it was which was attractive, you'd go there and you would not even look at any faults she had. So for the first few years, I trained myself. If I saw a beautiful girl come in the monastery, I'd always look for her pimples. And I'd always see one or two. And that was enough. She wasn't perfect enough. And the lust would just disappear. It's true, isn't it? All, and the same with the blokes as well. They've got their pimples or their bad breath or something. And that just takes away the lust and stuff. So it's only just actually the balancing. It's not to hate anybody. But the point was, in that particular story, the Buddha taught his young monks about, you know, a stupa. And then the Buddha went on retreat for a couple of weeks. And those monks, without a teacher, they really got into this a stupa, just they went too far. They looked upon their body and all they could see was this, you know, pus and ooze and dead stuff. And that's why they committed suicide, many of them. And when the Buddha heard that, he said, look, monks, you've gone too far. He said, instead, I'll teach you the state of meditation. You know what meditation he taught them? Anapanasati. The breath meditation. He said, that's the easy meditation, that's the soft one, there's no danger there. So a super meditation, if anyone gets into that, sometimes they can just go over the top and get into real negativity. And that's not what it's really meant for. It's just a balance. If anyone's got a lot of lust, balance a lot of lust. It's the same if you like to eat a lot. Sometimes as monks you were taught to do, when you eat your food, like tomorrow morning, your breakfast, somewhere in that food, whatever you're eating, somewhere in there is what comes out the other end. It's in there somewhere because, you know, the feces doesn't come from anywhere else. You get your food in the morning, some of the good stuff is taken out, what's left is the feces. So your feces must be on your plate there somewhere. You can't deny that, that's reason. So I used to do that for the monks who were eating a lot. I said, look, you're eating feces there. Other stuff as well, yeah, but it's all covered in there. But underneath there somewhere, you're eating feces. And so they didn't want to eat. And sometimes they got so upset they wouldn't eat at all. We realized they're teaching them too hard. So, you know, you can take that negativity too far. So this is what happened with that particular story. But you don't have to worry. Anapanasati is the safest of meditations. You can't get lost with that. That's why it's the safest one of all and the most successful. So if you haven't got a teacher, it doesn't matter. Just keep on going, piece upon piece upon piece. The insights will come up. The insights might shock you, but you'll be just so wonderful afterwards. Yeah. Well, maybe the first time, it's like seeing something completely new, which is always a bit scary. Because you didn't think it would be like this. And it means that, you know, you have to change the way you look at life. That's why it's scary, because we become so comfortable with the way we look at things. Which is, you know, even this is in psychology, it's called like, you know, denial. We're so comfortable, you know, with one way of looking at things, that, you know, it's like sometimes you think you're healthy. And then sometimes you might get a lump, you know, like in your prostate as a man. You know, no, it's only a lump, it's nothing really. You don't go to the doctors in time, you get prostate cancer. Like girls may get lumps in their breasts. And you're in denial, no, it's not happening, not me. And we don't face the facts. Now, truth can sometimes be scary, but it's best to face up to it as soon as possible and take the proper action, and that's the healthiest way. So you can see that sometimes truth can sometimes be very scary, but it's always the best way, because truth is most important. Make sense? It's scary at the beginning, but it's so relieving in the end. Okay, 1, 2. Go on, you first. Okay, that's a question which should really come up in 2 nights' time when I talk about enlightenment. But I'll answer it now anyway, it's a very simple answer. If a person gets the first stage or second stage of enlightenment, streaming or once returning, they can carry on with a normal family life without any problems whatsoever. The third and the fourth stage of enlightenment, though, being an anagami or an arahat, have different consequences. For the non-returner or the fully enlightened one, you can no longer have sexual relations. You can still live with your family, but fully celibate, just so simply, like a monk, but only a monk in a dress or a monk in trousers. For all intents and purposes, you're just so simple, so peaceful, not wanting very much in the world. And if you're an arahat, you usually join the sangha. And I'll explain why in a couple of days' time. Why that's the case? Have you had another question over here? Yeah. Ah, compassion, loving kindness. Great question. When you have no self left, you've got no business with you anymore. So you have all the time in the world for other people. One of the reasons why we're not compassionate to others is because we've got too much business to do for ourselves. So imagine what it's like, which is nothing you need, nothing you want. So your business is all done. So you spend the rest of your life doing other people's business, which is called compassion. As long as you've got something to do for yourself, sometimes it's prior commitments, which gets in the way of being kind to others. So understand that answer? So compassion always comes from selflessness. The less self you have, the more compassion you have for others. So this is a great way. You find that the closer you become to being an arahat, the more you are a bodhisattva. That's why I gave a talk a couple of places recently. Because sometimes people keep asking, Now, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, actually that was a question this morning, which is the best? Are they different? No, they're not different. Exactly the same. The fastest way to become an arahat, before enlightenment, is to be a bodhisattva. Let go of everything and just be concerned about others. And the best way to be a bodhisattva is to be an arahat first. The two go together. Because wisdom and compassion will always be friends. Yeah? Your karma's not exhausted yet, can you go to a deep jhana state? As long as you've got the karma to be reborn as a human being, which you obviously have, then you've got enough karma to get to jhana and be fully enlightened. So you've got all the entry requirements. Each one of you have. You know, sometimes people say that. They say, you know, sometimes people say, I'm only a woman, I can't get into jhanas. That's why I built you up yesterday by saying, you have actually got much better karma to get into jhanas than the guys over there. Women have an easier time of it. And some say, I can't do it. I'm only a lay person. I'm only, a yogi. I can't do these things. Or sometimes people say that you can't get into jhana in this age, or you can't get enlightened in this age. The time for all these things is gone. That is not true. In this age, there are enlightened beings walking this earth. There are arahats alive today. There's non-returners, once-returners, people with psychic powers, people do all these amazing things. It's there today. So if they could do it, so can you. So that's encouraging. Because if people come along and say, you can't do it, it's impossible, then you won't. That's why sometimes people would say, well, maybe if you're a monk or a nun you can get jhanas, but lay people waste the time. And I really rebelled against that. I say, no, that's not true. In the time of the Buddha, many lay people got jhanas and they got all these wonderful attainments. No different these days than those days and these days. So, no difference. You can do it. So I've been teaching these jhanas for a while. Other people teach jhanas, so people didn't get them. So we prove those people wrong. You can do all of these things. You know, sometimes, just for a bit of light relief at the end of this deep talk, sometimes people say that in the time of the Buddha, people were so different than they are today. But if you want to find out for yourself, there is one of these books in the Tripitaka called the Vinaya. These are the rules of training for the monks and nuns. But before you actually get the rule itself, you get the story which led up to the rule. And rather than be inspiring stories, these are all the stories of the naughty monks and the naughty nuns. The ordinary ones, the ones you can relate to. Instead of the superstars, you see the ordinary ones. And they got some really funny stories. One of my favourite stories has actually come from the Bhikkhuni Vinaya. And this particular story, the nuns in Sawati, early in the morning, one of the nuns had the job of cleaning out the toilets, the latrines. So she got the bucket of, basically shit, and instead of actually putting it in the right place, she just chucked it over the monastery wall. Threw it over the wall, she was just being lazy. Unfortunately, on the other side of the wall was a man who was actually going to the palace for an audience with the king. So he was impeccably groomed in his best clothes. And there he was, walking along, expecting to go to the palace, when this big bucket of unspeakable filth fell right on his head. And you can imagine that he wasn't very pleased. In fact, he was furious. And he knew what was on the other side of the wall. It was one of these so-called bhikkhunis. These nuns had done that. And so he was so upset, he decided he was going to burn the whole monastery down. These are nuns. It's interesting, this is Miss Horn made a translation, he called them strumpets. You can work out for yourself the word which he was really referring to. These aren't real nuns, these are just loose women, he thought. And so he went in there just furious, about to burn down the whole monastery. Fortunately, there was a wise attendant of the monastery. And he saw this crazy guy, you know, smothered with feces, going in there with a torch. He said, "Where are you going?" "I'm going to burn this monastery down. These nuns, look what they've done to me. They can't get away with this. I'm going to burn the whole monastery down. This is not on." Now this layman thought very quickly. He said, "Really? You mean you've just been anointed with this holy matter from this holy, holy nun? That's auspicious." And this man said, "What, really? This is not ordinary filth, this comes from holy nuns. This is the most auspicious thing." And he sold that line to this mad person. He said, "Listen, this is so lucky." Just like, you know, Chinese people are really into luck. "This is so lucky. You go back and get changed. I'm sure that something good's going to happen when you go to the palace." And so he took that, he put away his torch, he went back, he washed and got changed, and when he went to the palace, I don't know if he told the king just to make sure the nuns were okay, but the king gave him this really big contract. And so the man was very happy and said, "This is better than holy water." However, when the story got to the Buddha called about and said, "You were very lucky that time, thanks to that man, but don't do that again." And so now it's an offence of Pajitya to throw feces over the wall of a nun's monastery. It was one of the rules. And of course, I think, until that story, you could relate to that. That might happen. I mean, it's just, you know, people do stupid things. And so people in the time of the Buddha and the time today are exactly the same. They haven't changed it a bit. And you can see from that, if they can become enlightened, so can you. If they could get into jhana, so can you. Their characters, if I could pluck any one of you, you could see there was a person just like you in the time of the Buddha, who also became fully enlightened. So that gives you huge encouragement. You can do it. Okay, I just told that story because it's a very deep talk on deep insight, and that's just a bit of fun and games for the end. So I hope you enjoyed that story. Now you can actually share the merits with all sentient beings, the sharing of merits.
Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Very good. Okay, so good night everybody. Those staying here, hope you have a nice night's meditation or sleep. And tomorrow night's talk is on emptiness. Carrying on from deep insight to the nature of anatta. Who's in there? Tomorrow I'll tell you who you are.